we had to look for were missile installations, and about the only opportunity one had to see these, unless it was purely accidental, was when you were taking off and landing in an aircraft, because they're civilian aircraft, usually passed over a bunch of missile installations, and they're almost unmistakable. They look just exactly the same, whether they're in Colorado or in the Ukraine. So that was something that you always look for. We weren't terribly successful. We did occasionally find a new one. Also, when you passed by on a road, and most of the missile installations, of course, are either on rail routes, and they're not far, only 2 to 3 miles from the rail route, or roads, because they have to bring these things in and out of there, and parts and people and support stuff, so you can't get them too far off in the boonies. Another interesting and probably more successful endeavor was on naval construction, because they have to construct submarines and warships in naval dockyards. The only one that we could not get into was Sevastopol, but there are lots of places down on the Black Sea and also in near Leningrad where they're building ships. And this was fairly successful because our naval guy would go along and decide that they were building 3 new type cruisers or submarines. And of course the submarines are all prefabbed. They come from, the prefab bits come from all over the Soviet Union, right from the Black Sea, right up to the Baltic. And they put them together in Leningrad, and so there they are, right for everyone to see. And you can see all the nuclear submarines pieces being put together. So, okay, now that's the objectives, the training. Now, how do we get all this information or intelligence that our task is to obtain? Well, first one is direct observation of the scene. And I'm going to cover the sort of Moscow and Leningrad urban areas, because there is a tremendous amount of information there just by walking around or just driving around. And what you would see there was, firstly, military personnel. Now, the Soviet soldier has no civilian clothes. He wears his uniform all the time. And this applies to officers as well as other ranks. So by looking at military personnel and recognizing what their ranks are and what their units are, you can tell pretty well what organizations there are, get the order of battle, that sort of thing, in any place. Now, Moscow, of course, had a tremendous training establishment, so that there was a lot of people who were under training, and they sort of would walk out, and you'd see them in the evening or in the morning or whatever. And that became a very useful thing to get sort of troop strength in order of battle. Aircraft, of course, they pass across the sky, and unless you have your binoculars ready at the ready, you probably just say, "Oh, that's a jet," you see. But occasionally, you would see some of them in the sky that were individually identified. And they never had an air show, but they used to do formation flying south of Moscow, and that was one possibility of seeing some of these guys operating. Military publications, as I mentioned before, were very useful because they were for sale at the open bookstores, also the military bookstores, where you could go in and buy them, and we just went in and picked them up and took them home. There was some very, very useful stuff on vehicles and weapons. So you could get, it was sort of a thing where the Russian soldier could go in and buy a pamphlet on something that he was using. So those were excellent. We got quite a few visits. In other words, the attachés would be invited to visit a training establishment. We went to Tank Academy, we went to a research establishment, we went to the infantry school, and you got an idea of just how good their soldiers were. And mind you, they had the best ones out there for us. We had no doubt about that. But we had a chance to talk with them and ask them how they liked their training, whether it was hard or they figured it was worthwhile. And they did a lot of, we got a lot of interesting stuff, those things. Then there were social receptions. Now these were a mixed blessing, because you had to try and, you know, be very circumspect about any questions you ask, and you wouldn't ask any leading questions, but quite often you got some interesting remarks, especially from the satellite countries. I spoke French to the Romanians and Russian to the Bulgarians and the Hungarians, and they were quite you know, they would say a heck of a lot more than the actual Russians were. Of course, we had a Russian sort of a protector who went around with us to make sure that we didn't get these guys into too much conversation. But one of I think I may have mentioned this before, one of the occasions we went to the Tank Academy and Research School it was, and there we found a fellow building a gyroscopic navigation system for their tanks, which is a real problem, navigating a tank, especially at night. You don't have any maps or anything you can't see anything. And standard compass doesn't work too good in a tank. So they were building a gyro controlled navigation system, which projected the path of the tank on a map. And we had just finished one of those in Canada, you see, and I was the project officer, actually, for part of it. And so I got to talk to this scientist who was working on it, and gee whiz, I was saying, we've made one of those. He said, yes, I know. So, obviously, he'd had our pamphlet, and he said, I said, well, we have a lot of problems with this because it takes us about 90 minutes to run up the gyros, so they're stable, you see, from the start up of the tank. You either have to run the gyros all the time, which runs your batteries down, or you have to, have 90 minutes notice before the thing's any good. And I said, they've got to start off in the right azimuth, otherwise the whole thing's backwards. He said, yes, that's our problem too. And so my little protector who was there said, oh, there's something very interesting, Colonel, in the next room here, you must see it. He dragged me away. But that's the sort of thing, you know. Okay, we wouldn't have had that before if I hadn't. Then there's a lot to be obtained in museums and exhibits. The Russians are great for putting everything in a museum. They've got the Army Museum, they got the exhibition of science and achievement, and it's just fantastic, the stuff that you can get out there. And it's a lot of it isn't military. For instance, with the scientific exhibition of science and achievement, they had a new gas pipe. This thing was about 4 meters high, 12 feet, you know, and they had an exhibition of how these guys were welding the stuff together, and how they overcame permafrost with this thing. And, you know, it was tremendous. We went out there and talked to the guys and asked questions, and they told us all about it. We never had no idea. That technology did not exist in Canada. And, of course, it was Russian technology, and it's been in. They use those now, this now to take gas all the way to Paris, I think. Then TV and cinema were also, you know, that sounds like a pretty innocuous thing, but a lot of stuff on TV, that they like having pictures of their maneuvers and things for propaganda purposes on TV. So we had a TV watch for a while. We had a full-time TV watch, but it didn't turn out to be really very labor effective, because you had to have a guy watching it with his VCR ready to push any time there was something interesting. He had to know what was on. But then I said, again, libraries and bookstores were another source, and I had to spend a lot of my time off in libraries and bookstores. With the library, it's very difficult, because you had to know what you want, you had to go to put your name down, and they wouldn't give you the book right away. It was always 4 or 5 days before you got a postcard in the mail saying your book is ready, come and get it. And some of them were restricted. You could only read them in the reading room. So, and then they say, oh, well, why do you want to read this anyway? You know, that seems to be unusual. So bookstores were much, much better, because the way the bookstores work is, at the beginning of the year, they come up with a catalog showing all the books that are going to be published that year and how many copies are going to be of them and where they'll be available. So you immediately set out, an order form and ask for them. And when they come in, you get a postcard in the mail, and you go down and buy your book. So we got a lot of books that way. But I found another and easier way was to drop into a military bookstore out of Moscow in some little boonie town. And they were just sitting there on a shelf, and you could pick up, thumb through them and pick up the ones that you wanted. One of the objectives we had, for instance, I was supposed to look for a book showing the wages paid to all workers in the Soviet Union. It comes out once a year. And gee, you know, what has that got to do with military? Well, it does, because it tells how many workers there are, what portion of the GNP is going into various parts, and if you subtract that all, you know what portion of the GNP is going into the military. So, you know, it was one of those things that you don't understand it at first. So, okay, now what do we do? How do we go around gathering all this information? Well, firstly, other than Moscow, where you had to keep your eyes open and your neck from getting what we called Moscow neck, looking at all the antennas that were sitting up on the roofs, new ones, microwave, various things, we traveled. Now, we didn't travel by ourselves. We always went with at least one other person, and preferably four of us in a group. And sometimes they were all Canadians, sometimes they were mixed Canadian, U.S., and U.K., or occasionally we'd take along an Italian or sometimes even Japanese guys used to go along on these trips. Now, in order to make the trip, you had to do a lot of preparation, and this was a large portion of our duties was to prepare the trip, because you had to decide where you wanted to go, what the objectives were, how many days you're going to spend in each place, the method of going, the number of people that are going. Quite often we would go with our wives, because that was, we don't want to leave them at home all the time. They like to travel too, and also they're very useful on one of these trips. And so usually there would be three objectives or three places where you would travel to, and it could be, say, from Moscow to Kyiv would be the first one, and then, say, from Kyiv to maybe Minsk, and then from Minsk to Leningrad, and then from Leningrad back to Moscow. And most of the travel was by air. Occasionally you'd go by train. And in each of the places you had an objective to find out some of the things that we said, the troop strengths, who's there, is this very active or not active or what, and the numbers of military people. That was fairly easy, because you just walked around. And when all the soldiers, they quit work from 5 to 7, I think. And they had to go back to the barracks again for political talks and various other things. So from 5 to 7, you go to all the stores, just the big, sort of like Eaton's or the Bay kind of stores. And it would be just full of soldiers. They just came out of their barracks and whipped down there to see what was new and what could they buy. Didn't have a chance to buy very much or spend their money, but they'd be all there. So you just stand around and count the number of majors and colonels and sergeant majors and troops and the color of their epaulettes and the kind of badges they had on. And boy, I'm telling you, you could after a couple of days of that, you had everything right down. Of course, you had to. We couldn't take maps with us, or if we did, they were very fundamental. We didn't want to get caught with any maps that showed where barracks were and that sort of thing. But you always took a compass, and we made maps up on little pieces of paper that showed where we were going to go and the salient points. To if you got lost, you could. So we had a very rudimentary form of. We had little pieces of paper with pinpricks on them, and they were innocuous pieces of paper, but by reading the pinpricks you knew where you're supposed to be going. You put a map over the top of it. It was difficult to really record the things, and a good memory was a terrific thing here. Some people could just see something, you remember exactly where it was. I was never this fortunate. And we used little tiny notebooks and tiny pencils, and would record numbers and things in your pocket so that no one would really know what you're doing. We tried audio recording on tape recorders, but tape recorders we had were all very tiny, and they were in the sort of initial stages of development, and none of them was very satisfactory. Today you can get one that'll go in a pencil, and believe me, it's just a tremendous thing, but we didn't have any then. And so tape recording was not terribly good. Observation was probably the best thing, plus photography. And here we had to be, as I said, circumspect, because you don't want to be taking any pictures of a military installation, or you'd have somebody jumping on you. But what we did was we pretended we had idiot cameras. We had cameras that looked like Kodaks, but weren't. And we hung them around our neck and just kept them there all the time. And so you never knew whether the guy was taking a picture with an idiot part of his camera or the real part of his camera. And that was fairly successful. We did a lot of photography. Again, that takes training. You don't become a good photographer overnight, and the little bit of training that we had in back in Canada certainly didn't make us good photographers, but sometimes you're lucky. I was fortunate because I'd always been an amateur photographer, so I got right onto it. Cameras we had were, I would say, not adequate. They didn't have any, they were all, at the time I first went there, they were all Leicas. They didn't have any through-the-lens reflexes, so it meant you had to do everything by instinct. You had to set the aperture and the time on it by looking, and sometimes we got some bad pictures. So if you got good pictures, you were lucky. But there were a lot of good pictures came out of there. Nowadays, of course, with everything automatic, all you have to do is take the thing and you hold it in your hand and just press it, and it runs the film forward and the whole schmear. So you should be getting some good pictures. Again, when you were in the boonies on the travels, we always listened to the radio or looked at TV, because it was often quite different from when we got back in Moscow. And of course, the bookstores were more open than the ones in Moscow. Another thing that we tried to do is to either photograph or steal telephone books. Now, in the Soviet Union, they don't have telephone books. You don't get one. That's only for offices and that sort of thing. So you're supposed to know all the people that you want to call, and you don't need a telephone book. So they had, as an objective, to get up. I don't know that anyone ever got a Moscow telephone book unless they stole it or bought it. But occasionally there was one place that we used to go to that we would try and copy the telephone book. Now, the purpose of this, of course, it tells a lot about the government structure in the telephone book and how many people are working in various different enterprises. On these walks or trips, we were always followed, of course, and this is one of the things that made it difficult to get a trip. You had to ask permission, and sometimes they would deny permission because there were troop movements going on, or there was some other reason that they would give you, that there was no accommodation, or that you couldn't get transportation there or something. There was always a whole bunch of phony reasons why you couldn't go. But the real reason was that it took, I think it was five people, surveillance people, for every person that went on the trip. So if you had four guys going on a trip, that meant 4 times 5 is 20. They had to have 20 people. And there was one period of time in which we could never get a trip because everyone was on leave all the surveillance KGB guys were all on leave, and it didn't matter where you wanted to go or how simple it was, you could never get to move at that time. And so this part of the trip was difficult. We used to, as I say, go by rail or air or sea or whatever. But and this all had to be coordinated beforehand. You had to get tickets from the, as I was saying, we had to coordinate our trip and plan it, and have also, because we never were sure that we were going to get the trip, we had to plan and coordinate an alternate, because you would file your main trip with the KGB rep, or the fellow that were actually, it was the Soviet Army attaché liaison people. But if it was a trip that looked like, for some reason or other, they wouldn't give it to you, or that you knew the Americans had tried there last week and they didn't get it. Sometimes they let Canadians go when they wouldn't let Americans or Brits go. They thought we were kind of dumb, I guess. But we always had an alternative one up our sleeve, and if sometimes you'd put in a sucker trip, hoping they'd turn it down, and then that they'd immediately ask for another one, and you would probably get that one, or maybe even the third one you'd get, which is really the one you wanted anyway. And as I say, we had to file this trip and show what portion was air, what was rail, and what was automobile. And the observation, of course, from an automobile is much, much better than the rail or air. All you ever saw and the airplane was taken off and landing. The rest was usually up above the clouds. And they tried to sucker you into a seat with no window in it. And they would say, oh, yes, this is a reserved seat for you, sir. And here you'd be sitting in this seat right behind the lavatory, which usually leaked out urine. And you couldn't see anything anyway. So our standard ploy for this was to say, no, I'll get sick if I sit there, because I must be able to see the ground or see outside. You want me to be sick? That usually worked. As I say, observation was a matter of luck in many, many cases. Although once or twice we really lucked in, because we were down on the Black Sea at a place called Sukhumi, and we were flying to Batumi, and that's right at the south part of the Black Sea. It's a resort area. And because of weather, we got grounded at a place called, halfway in between, called Poti, which they just couldn't go on. It was a big thunderstorm, and the aircraft was grounded. They had to find us a place to stay for the night. And this was right down in their air defense area, so they weren't very happy about that. So the next morning, the only plane they had out was a little Hedgehopper, I think a 24-passenger job, which had to fly under the clouds. So we saw all this coast area that we weren't supposed to. And as I say, that was really lucky, because here was all the missile sites and aircraft stuff down there that we never have a chance to see. One of the perils of this, of course, was that you were followed everywhere, and by the most ugly-looking people that I've ever seen in my life. And some attachés actually got beat up, or there were spontaneous riots against these spies. You know, they would say, "You're a spy." You'd be in a restaurant or something, and some guy would come and sit at your table, and he said, "I understand you're a Canadian spy." And we said, "No, we're just doing our job, same as your guys doing in Canada." And so we never really had. I was tempted a couple of times to pop one of these idiots who pretended to be drunk, but he wasn't. So we kept a low profile, and had a fair success at it that way. There were some attachés, mostly American, who had a high profile, and they usually got a little bit of information and then kicked out of the country. But one of the things, of course, on a traveling, especially by a car, is that you were in a different hotel every night, and the hotels were, some of them were good and some of them weren't. We had a hotel list that had the good hotels and the bad hotels. The good hotels, you had a toilet with your room. The bad hotels, you didn't. You went down the hall, and they were pretty awful. And so we always used to go with plenty of deodorant and toilet paper and soap. Sometimes when we go by car, we would have continuous surveillance and a tail. All the cars were bugged, because your car had to go in for inspection for safety check. It didn't matter whether it was a Soviet supplied car or it was your own private car. They all had to have this safety check, in which they put on a radio transmitter and a radar target indicator, so that you could almost never lose the sauce. The only time that I ever lost them was when I was bringing a car in from Helsinki, and it hadn't been bugged yet, and they had a hard time keeping up with me on that trip. But the other times, they'd catch you right as soon as, you might escape for 5 minutes or so, but they'd be right after you. And, we think that all these things on James Bond are kind of far-fetched, but they're not. They got them. Well, so do we, as a matter of fact. Well, I should mention something about another aspect of the life, and that was your social responsibilities, which was really part of the diplomatic tasks you had to do. There were official receptions, which you had to go to, Soviet ones, and official receptions from all the countries, and there are about 57 different countries. And so the attachés were usually elected to go to them. Fortunately, we had three attachés, so we could farm these things out and didn't all have to go to all the receptions. There were official parades, usually the 7th of November and the 1st of May, and all of us went to those, of course, because we could take pictures there with cameras. They didn't care. There were a lot of dinner parties. In fact, somebody described life in Moscow as diplomatic incest, because everyone was inviting everyone else to their parties, and you had lists of people who you hadn't invited, and you had people who were very unhappy if you couldn't come or didn't come. There were a fair amount of non-social activities too. Our people used to get tickets to the to the ballet and to special films they had. They got them through the embassy. They weren't free by any means, but we had a chance to get them, which the ordinary Russian had to wait in line for. Now, all the chauffeurs and the maids were Russians. They didn't allow us to, at least we didn't have any Canadian staff of that sort. And I was quite certain that both our maid and my chauffeur were KGB operators. The chauffeur was, I'm sure he must have been a captain when he started, and I think he got promoted because he learned to speak English a lot better than he did when he first started. And but we caught him out a couple of times because my wife and I would switch languages in between. We'd be speaking in Russian back and forth, which he could legitimately join in with, and then we'd switch to a question in English, you see, and he would answer the question in Russian. So either his comprehension became very good, or else he knew a lot more than he's letting on to. But it was interesting because we learned a lot about their life, and of course both of them had served in the armed forces, or they said they did, so they knew something about what was going on. We never were the object of, at least the apparent object of any attempts on seduction or entrapment by the Russians, although they might have tried it. They had some pretty good looking maids, I'll tell you. And but no one ever tried on me. Maybe they didn't think I was a good target. However, they did get one American chap, and they got a whole bunch of Marines. And many, many years ago, we used to have RCMP guards there, and they were all young chaps, maybe 22, 23, unmarried, and boy, they were just super targets. So they had to replace them with old, worn-out, retired commissionaires, people like that who obviously weren't going to, who took their families with them as well. You were always a target of surveillance and security. Any mail that came through the regular mail system, we're not supposed to do that, usually it all went diplo bag, but any mail at all that you got, whether it's commercial or not, was obviously opened and read. Any telecommunications was also surveilled the same way, that is commercial stuff, and telephone was, we knew they had taps on it. In fact, in our apartment, was not only telephone was bugged, but all the rooms were bugged. And they had a special room in this apartment, or the building, and accidentally they had some trouble with the wires, I think, and I just was passing this room, looked in, and here was cable system for, it looked like a small battleship. And I said to the guy that was fixing it, he said, "Oh, you having trouble?" He said, "Oh, yeah, it's almost fixed now, sir, it's almost fixed now." Of course, I spoke to him in Russian, so he didn't know whether I was one of the guys in the listening post or not. But there was no doubt about it. They used to check out their system late at night, and they'd send through a very high-frequency note. It's supposed to be supersonic, so that it wasn't aware of it. We weren't aware of it, but they checked microphones out. They had this transducer that was located somewhere in the thing. But the Russians are very, very punctual, and it was always at, I think it was 2 o'clock or 2:10 that they'd turn it on for our apartment. They must have checked all the apartments through, but our apartment was 2:10. And we had a cat, a Russian cat, and of course the cat can hear supersonic sounds that we can't hear. And this cat would get really mad, get up and so every morning at 2:10 I'd say, "Oh gee, they didn't check the bug today." Cat slept right through. So that's, and of course the embassies were, as far as possible, we tried to keep them secure, but you really couldn't. They had systems there that don't require any wires to them. They were radio reflective, and they were completely passive in nature. They had one that was in the American embassy. It was just a dipole on a window, and they had this thing glued to the window, and actually it was in between two panes of glass. It just looked like one pane of glass. These dipoles were in, and of course the window, if you're talking in an office, the window will vibrate, and then they sprayed the radar signals on there. The radar signals are reflected back. Of course you can tell what people are saying inside. That was it took them a long time to figure that out. And then they had one, and the ambassador was given a a seal of the United States for his office, and they examined it very carefully, you know, seeing sort of a trap in it. There didn't appear to be, it appeared to be carved out of one piece of wood, and so they put it up in his office, and the sweep team that checks these out, the ambassador was sitting there, and he was asked to read something, and sure enough, it was coming out loud and clear right out of this bloody thing. And it, again, it was one of those a passive type systems. And well, the Americans were real suckers for this. Their cars were bugged, and their TVs were bugged. And the ambassador, American ambassador, when I was there, had a Chinese manservant. Now, he'd been in China, and this guy was a real Chinaman. You know, he wasn't an American Chinaman. He was a Chinese Chinaman. He had a Chinese passport, which was, you know, sort of thing that one doesn't really want to do. Anyway, he gave this guy his shoes to be repaired. They needed new heels. So the Chinaman took him somewhere out on Sibby Street and had him repaired. Came back, oh, very good, yeah, okay. And so the sweep team were coming around, and they heard the ambassador talking over there. You know, they sweep through all the radio frequencies. What's the ambassador doing? You know, where is he? Oh, he's out in the garden. So they went over to the ambassador, and louder and louder, and sure enough, in his shoes was a little transmitter, which was picking up everything he said and transmitting it to somebody. So anyway, you really couldn't be...
Was it hard to conduct your business with all this surveillance going on? How would you...
Oh, yes. Well, we had a safe room, and this thing was electronically and soundproof, which, you know, was only a small place, but we got in there, and there was no way. It was a Faraday cage for electronics, and it had soundproofing, and it had its own air conditioning in it that was self-contained, so there was no tubes or pipes going out of it. And that's pretty hard to do, because everything had to go through filters. You know, the AC that went through there also went through the rest of the system, but they had a special generator that isolated it from the Russian system. And so you had what was called the hot wire and the cold wire, and the hot wire was the one that was outside. It was not safe, but then the generator, it was just a motor and a generator, and they just turned but physically isolated the electrical circuits that ran this safe room. And we did this for a lot of the things that we didn't want, like, for instance, the crypto equipment that had to be isolated. So one of the interesting things was a question of how much steam they used. Of course, this is the steam was being generated by nuclear power plants, and they weren't really going to tell us how much nuke they had, anything like that. But all of Moscow is heated by steam or hot water, and they have great big power plants there that they claim do all the heating. But it's a central heating system, and there's great pipes that go through the city, and this avoids a lot of pollution, actually, because the only pollution comes from the steam plant. And we counted the number of steam plants there were and tried to figure out what the kilowatts of energy required and how much was being delivered, and the rest must be all electricity, which came from a nuclear plant. But steam is a great thing. They love steam. They got steamboats and steam turbines, and a lot of their cable stuff is still steam electric generators. And of course, this is a great debatable point in the Soviet newspapers, because some of their old coal electric and coal steam generators produce a hell of a lot of pollution. It just pours out of the top. And there's always some environmentalist writing letters to the papers about this. And they still have a lot of steam engines on their rail system, although they've gone over to diesel. But they still kept all those World War II Lend-Lease U.S. steam engines. They're sitting in, as you go along, you'll see them sitting on the sidings, just hundreds and hundreds of them. And of course, coal is they have a tremendous amount of coal resources. And as you go down through the Don Basin, you'll just see these great big heaps of coal, you know, maybe 100 meters high. And they're just still piling the coal in there, and it just stays there. So that was an interesting aside. Their television at the time, they just had color television in, and so we used to watch that with great interest. Not only was it entertainment, but it also had a lot of good stuff on it that, you know, You had so many objectives that you'd sort of say, oh, look, there's something. That's what we're supposed to be. Write it down. See, take pictures of it. It wasn't too good at the time because they hadn't figured out how to take pictures on television. You know, if you take a picture on television, you get there's so many lines. Although they had more lines than ours does. So you've got better pictures off Soviet television than they did off ours. Well, I think that that covers sort of the general travels. I can't say that my efforts there were terribly, you know, that we did a lot of things. We had a lot of objectives. Some of them we got a few of them that we were quite satisfied that we got as much as could be obtained. But some of them, the little asides, were we had a agricultural attaché. He was from Industry, Trade, and Commerce, and we were very interested. Canada was very interested in finding out just what the agricultural resources are going to be. In other words, did the wheat crop fail this year? Are they going to be buying more wheat from Canada, or where are they going to buy it? And so he used to have to go out on the road down to Ukraine and find out what the condition of the crops were. Well, that was pretty easy because you just go along and grab some wheat and say, geez, it's all rusty, or it's not very good, or it's a tremendous year this year, they're going to have a good crop. And plus other natural resources too. We had an objective to find out what they were doing with their potatoes. Now, can you think of anything more mundane than an attaché finding out what they're doing with potatoes? Well, there's a reason for this. You see, they make missile fuel out of alcohol, and the alcohol they get from potatoes. So what we had to do was to go down to in potato harvesting time and follow a potato truck to see where it was going to go. And then, because they usually had a central dump agency, or sometimes it went straight into a distillery. We discovered a lot of distilleries there. And it was easy to find these potato trucks because they came off the road. They were mud covered. So all you do is drive along, you find a bunch of mud on the road, follow the mud, and you come out at the distillery. So there's a, you know, I never thought I'd be following a farm truck to find out what he did with his potatoes. Also, give you an idea of, you know, you had to get what the standard of living was like, what food is on the market. So you go to the marketplace and find out whether there was a shortage of stuff. And of course, there always was. How much consumer goods were on the market? Is there a black market? Yeah, there sure is a black market. Consumer goods, you know, where they go to? Are there any regional disparities? In other words, does Moscow get everything, or can you get lots of stuff in Kiev, or what? So, and what's the distribution system? Was it good, bad? Is it breakdown? You know, these are all sort of things that you wouldn't really think that was a military attaché's a job. But as I say, these were interesting, if nothing else. I must tell you one story. Our agricultural attaché said he saw a missile site and showed it to us, or he thought it was on the map. He was going from there to there. He said, "Well, what does it look like?" "Well, it's a great big sort of silo thing. It's it's a road leading up to it, and there's a great big barn door on it, like a hangar, aircraft hangar, and it's things about 60 feet high and about 80 feet wide, and there's trucks going in and they don't come out." So we said, "Hey, that sounds rather funny." So we checked out and see if there was any reports of a that sort of thing down there. And no, there weren't no satellite pictures of it. So we said, "Well, we better go and find out where it is." So he told us exactly between where it was. So the next trip we went down there, and sure enough, here's this great pile of earth with two doors in the front end, and trucks going in and out. So we stopped to see what they had in the trucks, and they were full of grain. It was a silo. The guy stopped there. He wouldn't know what they were doing. It was a, but it certainly doesn't have anything more significant than grain in it. But we could never figure out why the trucks went in and never came out, but they went right through. They just went. They came out the other side and off another road. So that's a sort of a quick run over my life in Moscow. I should also tell you that I was accredited to Finland, and this was very useful because we'd get tired of Moscow, and so we'd go and spend a week or or so in Finland, which was a completely different country, and it was much more westernized than one would imagine. Now, the Finns, of course, fought two wars against the Russians. There was the Winter War of 39, in which they really beat the Russians, although finally they were forced to submit just by pure weight of numbers, but they sure taught the Russians a lesson that they put to good use when they were fighting the Germans. And at that time, the border with Finland was right in the outskirts of Leningrad, right a few miles north, so that part of the treaty for the Winter War was that they took it way up to Viborg, which was almost halfway to Helsinki, and kicked all the Finns out and replaced them with Russians. Well, then when the Germans attacked the Soviet Union, the Finns decided they'd get all their territory back, so they started the second Russian-Finnish War with the aid of not too many Germans, but the Germans did use Finland as a base. But the thing was that the Finns were right back to Leningrad within days. They kicked all the Russians out of the Lake Ladoga area, and stayed there until almost the end of the war, because it wasn't really considered a very important front by the Russians. Leningrad, of course, was, and the Germans were all south of Leningrad. Well, anyway, we got a fair amount of information from the Finns, the Finnish officers who were involved with using Russian equipment. They weren't supposed to say anything to us, but they certainly let us know, you know, what their problems were, and so we had a fairly good relationship with them, and they liked Canadians, and most Finns have got relations or families or have visited Canada, and a lot of Canadians go to, you know, Finnish Canadians go to Finland, so there's a good rapport. It was quite different than in the, and a welcome relief to go and spend time in Helsinki or Turku or wherever. They used to invite us up for winter maneuvers, and that was always fun, because you'd tear around watching guys on skis they ran a system of, let's see now, what was their military, compulsory military training, which they have, similar to the Soviets, but it's only 1 year. And so they squeeze in 1 year what the Soviets do in 2 years. Of course, there's another reason for the Soviets keeping the guys for 2 years, because you can train a soldier in 1 year. He's just as good a soldier as, after all, we got trained in about 6 months in World War II and 3 months in World War I. And mind you, things are getting a little more complicated now. If you want a guy to run a computer, you don't train him in 1 year. But they were doing in 1 year what the Soviets were doing in two, and what the Americans were doing in two for their call-ups. But they did this by working sort of 6 days a week and 12 hours a day. Well, the Finnish Communist Party, at the behest of the Russians, introduced union hours and pay for overtime. So these guys, poor guys, could only work 8 hours a day. If they wanted to work on Saturday, they had to get a time and a half. And you know, this practically ruined the complete military budget. But it was done by the Communist Party at that time was pretty strong. You know, it was almost a communist government, but they managed to push this through. And of course, the Finnish officer is saying, "Good God, how can you train a guy in 8 hours? And he goes out on an exercise that takes 12 hours. He gets 4 hours of overtime. It's ridiculous." So, however, their air force was pretty good. They had some Sov MiGs, and they had a bunch they had some Swedish planes, and they had some British planes. So they had a mixed bag, and the ones that they could get parts for were the ones that they flew, which were mostly the Swedish and British ones. Their navy was not very big, because it had consisted mostly of torpedo boat MTBs, motor torpedo boats, at the beginning of the Winter War. And they took a expedition down to the main Russian naval base at Kronstadt, and they sank about half the fleet that was at anchor there with these MTBs. And so part of the peace treaty was that the Finns were never to have any MTBs in their Navy. So their Navy is mostly minesweepers and small vessels, but it's still a pretty active Navy, and from what our naval attaché said, was as good as any that he's ever seen. So that was our sort of relief, comic relief, I would say, if anything. But we enjoyed it very much, and we spent up to, in the wintertime, up to a month there, and had all sorts of things, learned how to take saunas and jump into cold lakes and that sort of thing. We had one of these maneuvers, all the attachés, including a Soviet attaché, British, American, and others, went to a sauna, and this was in the middle of a park in downtown Helsinki. It was a park and a lake, and snow on the ground. So we went in the sauna and got all steamed up, and then they said, "Well, now, gentlemen, there's showers here if you want to have a shower, but we have this lake, and we're all going out in the lake." This was the Finns. So he said, "We've broken a big hole in the ice, and you can just jump in or swim around or just get your feet, you know." So, of course, the Americans said, "Oh, well, we're going in the lake." So the British, I looked at the Brit, and I said, "Are you going in the lake?" He said, "Well, the Americans are going, I guess we'd better go." I said, "Okay, I'm going in the lake." The poor Soviet attaché had, and he was a great big guy, and, you know, he was obviously wasn't fit for that, but he jumped in the lake with us. He had guts, if nothing else, and unfortunately he died of a heart attack a few months later. I don't know if it had anything to do with that, but he did. But at any rate, he sure as hell wasn't going to let his side down by not going in. And I must say that other than the first shock of going in, I didn't dive in. I mean, I took a back, went down the steps until my feet were in the water, and then just flapped over backwards, so, you know, that wasn't really too bad. But boy, it sure takes your breath away. And other things. So, that was a better place to be as a military attaché. And of course, I've met a lot of military attachés, and the conditions that some of them have are, you wouldn't really call it a hardship posting at all. The one in France was just a super job. And Poland was more difficult. The Iron Curtain countries, they gave us a tough time, and Poland was one of the ones that we got a tough time. And some of the other Iron Curtain countries tried to outdo the Soviets in surveillance and meanness and, you know, just general unpleasantness. But I must say that my 2 years there were not regretted at all. I think it was one of the better postings that I've had. We could have done more if we'd had better training, and I think this is one of the shortcomings, and I think I'd like to end up on this note, and hopefully this has been corrected, because I know many reports on it, but, you know, people say, "Oh, well, we can't spare the people the money, we have got money to do this," and so you'll have to get along as best as you can. But it means that a lot of the time and effort that went in there was really wasted, because you don't have a guy who's a professional observer, and